So now let's take all of that XAML and binding stuff that I just showed you in the last hour and stick it up a notch, because now the addressing of some of the stuff from code behind, one of these guys just asked me, if I didn't want to use MVVM, what would be my solution? If I'm a brand new WPF or Silverlight developer, I don't want to use MVVM, what should I do besides leave the business? Who was that anyway? Who was it that asked me that? That was you. Okay, I didn't mean that personally, you know. And the answer is, well, if you're loading information from the database and you need to set a bunch of text boxes, you would need to set the text boxes programmatically or set the list box programmatically or do a lot of stuff from the code behind. And that's not what the MVVM pattern is about. And I'm going to go through this first, and then I'm going to give you at the beginning of the next hour, the one right after lunch, I'm going to start with a little five-minute exercise called Thinking in MVVM that I give credit to a friend of mine, a guy named Carl Shiflett, who works for Microsoft out in Redmond. And Carl put together this package that I'll discuss at a reference slide later on, that where he introduces this concept of thinking in MVVM, and he describes this little problem that we're going to use MVVM to solve. And what he didn't do was code up that problem, and I coded it up, and I have a before and after. The exact same problem coded a conventional way, just nothing but code behind, and it's got buttons and text boxes and everything on there. It's even got some color. And then the exact same solution, the exact same problem, but with a full-blown MVVM solution. And the idea is going to become very clear to you there as to how, why this pattern is so powerful and why you want to use it. And like I said earlier, I don't deal in absolutes a lot. When it comes to programming, it's a very personal thing. And it's very rarely that I'll say, you do it one way, the other guy can do it the other. It's very rarely that I say, always follow this pattern. And with MVVM, I'm going to break that tradition and say I strongly feel that if you're writing WPF applications or Silverlight applications outside of some throwaway stuff that I put together in 5 minutes to do a demo, anything that has any amount of seriousness, you do want to incorporate this pattern. It really was designed to go hand in hand with a technology like XAML, primarily because of the binding capability. MVVM is going to be, binding is going to be foremost on the mind of any programmer that deals with MVVM. Things are going to become state-driven. And I'll touch more on what I mean by state-driven as I continue. So this is more or less an intro to what MVVM is. We're going to talk about its goals and its purpose. Then we're going to do a couple of demos on MVVM binding and writing view models. And then we're going to go one step further, because MVVM is about encapsulating not only state, where a view model contains the state of our view, but it's also about encapsulating behavior. A view model could also encapsulate the behavior of a view. And the behavior is not only what the view shows, but what can the view do. And the simplest way to illustrate behavior is, for example, buttons. I mean, your views are always going to have some buttons on them because they're going to cause some action to take place. Well, you can encapsulate this action in your view models as well, and it's very important that you do so. Then we'll talk about converters, and converters is going to be the big one out of these three. If I have to sacrifice anything, it'll be events and navigation, because they're very, very minor. Converters are the big one. And somebody here just asked me about converters a couple of minutes ago. Who was it? Gentleman back there. So pay close attention, all right, young man? Then we'll touch on unit testing, because I'm not a TDD zealot. I'm not one of these guys that has, you know, the banner on their blog that says one red, green, refactor, I am test driven. I think that's like beyond nerdy, like really, really be a pathetically nerdy, okay? That's worse than baby on board. I do unit testing. I test what I think needs to be tested, and view models need to be tested. And it's very important to understand that with MVVM, you get the additional benefit that you can test your view models, meaning you can test the state and the behavior of whatever view is going to be bound to it later. You can test it, or you can't do that in the code behind. The code behind is very, very tightly coupled to the view. This is the case in the web, Windows, and XAML. You can't just instantiate the code behind class and start accessing things, because it depends too tightly on how those things are going to be displayed. So you need to separate these concerns a little deeper, and that's where the view model really starts to shine, is when you start to see testing. So you guys like my Cuban coder picture? That's the name of that JPEG file, Cuban coder. I stood in front of an audience in Bulgaria with this hat, the cigar, and the shirt. The only difference is they wouldn't let me light the cigar up. But I stood under my picture like this, and it was pretty funny. That's a traditional Cuban Ricky Ricardo hat. All right, so let's talk about what MBVM is, its goals and purposes. Okay, so originally this was not a Microsoft model. It was introduced by the guy that wrote the Bible on patterns. Everybody here knows who Martin Fowler is, I take it. Everybody know his book? Everybody owns his book, right? You gotta have this book on your shelf. Okay, Patterns of Enterprise Application Architecture. It shows you like 120 something patterns, and not all of them you use, but they're all brilliantly described. And he does Java and C# in the book, so it is kind of .NET driven. Where it became really popular is when Microsoft put the MVVM logo on it. It used to be called Presentation Model, and it was Microsoft that renamed it MVVM when they came out with their XAML technologies. Well, why am I holding my cane? When they came out with their technologies based on XAML, WPF and Silverlight. What it is, it's the layer that sits between the view and the model, not to be confused with the business layer, okay? You'll find some articles, and I want to prep you for what you're going to read about, because one thing about MVVM is that it's an extremely loose architectural pattern. It is one of those patterns that defines certain guidelines for doing things and then leaves the implementation of said guidelines up to your own interpretation as a developer. And there's nothing wrong with that. One person may do commanding a little different than the other. One person may build their view model hierarchy a little different than the next guy. There are some common things that every implementation of MVVM should follow, and that's the binding commonality. But one thing that I find in articles that I read are statements that, in my opinion, are just plain wrong and plain misleading. And one of them is that MVVM is a great way to separate the business logic from the view. And it's not a very accurate statement, because we're all good developers here, right? We've been separating the business logic from our UI for a very long time, right? That's what we got conventional three-tier architecture for: data layer, business layer, UI layer. You don't put business logic in the UI layer any more than you put data layer in the UI layer. The view model is not for that. The view model is to encapsulate state and behavior that has to do with driving the UI. The view model will usually contain a copy of the business model. We just call it the model, but it would be the business layer. It would usually contain a copy of a certain one or two business objects, or maybe more, within it so it can do its work. So usually you get a business object that contains a bunch of properties, contains behavior for saving itself to the database, for loading itself from the database. That's all business functionality, even performing calculations. That's all business functionality. Then we got the view model that encapsulates that, and that's designed to expose that business model to the UI. And you'll see different ways of exposing it as we go along. So it's the layer that sits in between there. Now, one thing that I will say is when you commit to MVVM, my personal recommendation is to commit 100% to it, meaning once you say I'm going to use the MVVM architecture for this application, I'm going to have a view model for every view. Just because you can still bind a regular business object to a view doesn't mean that you should. Now, if you don't want to use MVVM, then you are going to be binding business objects to view. But don't mix and match. Don't say these views are going to bind directly to the business tier and these views are going to bind just to a view model that then goes to the business tier, because then it just starts to get confusing. Try to standardize yourself on using the pattern or not using the pattern, whichever you decide. The view model is very loosely coupled to the XAML, unlike the code behind, which is tightly coupled. What this means is two things. Number one, the view has an indirect knowledge of the view model. The only knowledge the view has of the view model, if it's bound in programmatic code, which it typically is, it doesn't have to be, but it typically is, the only knowledge the view has of the view model is that the view is expecting to bind to certain properties, just like you saw that my view is bound to hero name and power. But the truth is, that view, in my example before and in examples coming up, does not give a damn about what object is in the background. It doesn't care. It doesn't even know that until runtime. However, it is expecting it to have a property called hero name and power. So I could have an object called Avenger. I could have one called superhero. I could have one called doofus and tights. As long as it has a hero name and a power property, all of those objects are going to work perfectly with that view. Does that make sense? So it's a loose coupling. It's an expected coupling with the properties, but not a tight coupling with the object. The view model has no coupling to the view. In fact, most of the time, I would recommend putting the view models in their own assembly. and referencing that assembly from the view assembly, which is your main WPF or Silverlight application, but not the other way around, because obviously you don't want a circular reference. So your view model does not know anything about any views. In fact, theoretically, your view model should be able to drive any view. And a lot of times, a single view model can drive more than one view. The only thing is that since this view model is exposing said number of properties, you know, these different properties, every view should be designed to bind to properties of those names. But one view can be representing some kind of graphical thing. The other view can be representing a matrix of data in a list. But the properties they're expecting are the same, so the same view model can bind to them. Does that make sense? All right. Now, it's a little different from MVC and MVP, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but one other thing, I'm just trying to correct things that you're going to read that I think are kind of misleading, because there's also scripture out there that says that MVVM is a modification of the MVC pattern. You know, it's slightly different from the MVC pattern. No, it's actually very different from the MVC pattern. In fact, in the MVC pattern, the model and the view are the same as in MVVM, model and view. The C stands for controller, and it means something totally different. I'll explain that in the next slide. But one additional thing that I'll say is that in a lot of MVC applications, the model turns out to be kind of a view model for the page, not exactly the business tier like the model would be in MVVM. A lot of times in MVC applications, John, correct me if I'm wrong here, a lot of times in MVC, and John's a diehard MVC programmer, in MVC applications, you have to create a specific data model that's designed to be bound to that view that may be slightly different from your business tier. Well, that is essentially what writing a view model is about. The whole idea about writing a view model is to make up for where the model falls short. Sometimes a regular business object or a group of business objects do not bind well to a view. And that's where the view model comes in and puts these things together. A lady here just 10 minutes ago said, who was the one that wanted to bind to more than one view model? That was one back there. What's your name? Michelle? Okay, so Michelle has a view, and she wanted to know, what if I need to bind part of my view to one view model and part of my view to another? That's a pretty bad practice. The general rule of thumb is to have one view model per view. But anything that you're going to need to bind in that view would be exposed as properties here. Well, then Michelle added, what if I have one collection that came from another view model? Well, then that collection is separate anyway. It's just exposed as a property in that view model. So expose that collection as a property of this view model. The idea is that the one view model encapsulates everything that's going to drive this view. But that collection might have come from one business object, this collection from another business object, and a bunch of other properties from a third business object that came from another database from around the world. And you may have some properties in there that also come from a service, from the Bing API. All of that wrapped up into one nice view model packaged together that can be tested, and then that single view model gets bound to the view as nothing more than property exposures. Make a little more sense? So, freaking controller. All right, so here's ASP.NET MVC, okay? Without getting too detailed into what these things are about, here's some differences, okay? You got a view, a controller, and a model. In ASP.NET MVC, who's an MVC developer in here? All right, you guys know that your URI includes a controller and an action, okay? That determines your point of entry. The URI defines how you're going to enter that application. Then you got to write your controller and then define your actions in your controller. You may not have an action in the URI, which means you can have a default action in the controller, but there's always going to be a controller and an action. And it's that controller that is going to determine, based on business information, model information, it's going to determine what view it's going to render. So in an indirect way, the controller has knowledge of the views. It's indirect because the views are instantiated using a string, so it'll still compile even if it doesn't know anything, if you wrote the wrong string in there, it'll still compile, and that makes the controller very testable because it doesn't have a direct dependence on the view. But there is some amount of knowledge on there. An MVP, which is one of the three or four patterns on which WebForms is based on, you got the MVP pattern, Model View Presenter, you got the front template controller, and you got a couple of others that make up the WebForms architecture. Your point of entry is the view itself. And the view depends on this presenter class, which is your code behind class, to do its work, to drive itself. There's a very tight coupling there. And we know that because when we go into the code behind class, we can access each and every control that's on that view right from the code behind. If you put a text box on the view called TXT1, you can access txt1.txt. How much tighter does it get? In fact, you could never even instantiate that class on its own, because the way ASP.NET architecture works is that that class, have you ever noticed that the code behind of a web form is defined as partial? That's because dynamically in the background, ASP.NET is building another partial class that doesn't physically exist, and it's building it based on the controls in the ASPX page. And only when those two classes are put together does the application compile. So if you try to manually instantiate your code behind class so you can try to test it, you may have references to TX to text box one that has no idea where these things come from, because that class doesn't exist physically. So it's not going to be testable. MVVM, the point of entry is actually either or. You can either come in the view using view first approach or view model first approach. So it's a lot looser. And I'm in the next hour after lunch, I'm going to talk about view model first. Everything in this approach, in this class, is going to be view first. What view first means is that, like traditional WinForms or WPF, in its conventional state, I am going to instantiate the view, and then I'm going to hook up the view model to the view. Whereas a view model first approach, it's a little different, and it's used in advanced scenarios, and I'll get into that in the advanced class, okay? All right, so the model is going to be your business tier for the main part. The view is going to be your XAML file. Whether it's a user controller or a window, that's going to be your view. And your view model, once again, responsible for UI logic. I have this very, very detailed here, even though you don't see me spend a lot of time on the slide, because I tend to be very verbose in my slides, because it's what a lot of attendees go back and look at when they leave here. So you'll find a lot of information here that I'll just talk about over the next hour, but I won't address this point by point. Okay? Now, here's another misconception that I'm tired of reading out there, and it just pisses me off every time I do. I see the forums. I monitor the forums once in a while, and I see people say, I'm new to MVVM. Can you tell me this, and this? Why am I going wrong? I did this in my code behind this and that. And then somebody posts an answer that says, you're doing it wrong because the goal of MVVM is to totally eliminate your code behind. If you're going to really make that the goal of your MVVM programming, you're at one point or another going to end up driving yourself crazy. Your hair's going to start to hurt and your teeth are going to bleed. And you're going to be up till 4 o'clock in the morning trying to get something to work that maybe was never meant to work in the first place. So what you should do with MVVM is make the goal of MVVM to 100. Here's an absolute statement for you. Make the goal of MVVM to 100% drive the view through data binding. If you can do that, I guarantee you, naturally and almost automatically, 99% of your code behind will go away almost immediately. The other 1% may stay around or may go away later on as your view model grows. But let it happen. Don't make the goal. Don't get pissed off. And I'm telling you this from experience. Don't look in your code behind and say, oh, shoot, I still got 3 lines here. What can I do now to make sure that I don't have those left? That's just the wrong way to approach this. That should not be. It's about getting the job done. It's not about being up till 4 o'clock in the morning just so you can say I proudly have an empty code behind. Because that's just ridiculous. I mean, unless you charge by the hour, isn't it? You know? So the goal should be state and behavior binding, okay? The goal should be that no XML element, I said this to 2 or 3 people earlier, no XML element, XAML element should be set programmatically. It should all be done through binding, okay? The elimination is a beneficial byproduct, okay? Now, let's talk about our first view model class. I'm going to jump straight to the code here because it's a lot more fun. Am I correct? Yes? All right. So we got a little problem here. We got this one object here, and this, get out of my way. This object is called source object. Very simple object, okay? It has a property called view title, which returns this hard-coded string, and it's got one other property. The property is called item. And that property is of an object type, as you can see. It's an object called child object. And that property has that object has a property called name. So we got a two-level object model with the first level having a property and a second property of an object, and that second object has one property. Make sense? So I just want you to keep that in mind. Keep that visualized, okay? Now, here's what I'm doing. I got a very simple view here. This is non-MVVM. This is conventional binding. Matter of fact, this first example really has nothing to do with MVVM. I wrote a regular view right here, and this view has a label with a text box and a submit button, okay? Now, that submit button is going to show me what's in the text box. How do I know that? Because I wrote it, silly. There, it's going to tell you what the text box is. And the data context is going to be set in the constructor. So this is view first, which means I'm going to load up this view. And in the constructor of the view, I'm going to set the data context of the view itself to an instance of source object. Simple enough? Now, let's see what I'm doing here. Hold on. I didn't set it as a startup project. Okay. So I'm going to type Miguel, and I'm going to say submit. And it says, the text box says Miguel. Now, why did it do that? Let's find out. Because that submit button does the following. It grabs the source object. How does it grab it? Well, initially, the source object was set in the data context, in the constructor, right? I don't want to ignore this side of the room. I'm sorry. I'm just kind of closer to this thing here, and I can't walk very well. So what I'm doing in the button click is that I'm grabbing the data context, because I know it's in the form, right? So I'm grabbing the data context. I'm casting it to what I know the object type is, which is source object, and I'm just showing you. The text box says source.itemName. And how do I know it's source.itemName? Well, let me go out to my view, because in this text box, look what I'm saying. I'm binding to name. Now, here's something you haven't seen yet. The original binding occurred at the form level, at the view level, this.dataContext, of source object. But what does source object contain? A property called item. And that's where name is, correct? So let's take a look at the view again, and look what I did in the view. The grid has the data context set to, and guess what? I told you before, every property can bind. Data context is not an exception. Just because data context contains the binding source doesn't mean that data context can't be bound to a property of the existing binding source. So my existing binding source is the source object. Now the grid is going to have its data context bound to the item property of whatever the previous data context was. And that's where source object, that item, comes into play. So now from the grid on down, what am I working off? Source object or source object.item? Dot item, exactly, which is why the text box just says plain old name. And down here, the window actually has its title bound, the view title. So I used up the source object properties until it came time for me to use the item properties. And rather than do it programmatically, since item is a property of my previous data context, I just set the binding, the data context, this way. If I would eliminate this right here, what do I have to change this to for it to work? Item.name, exactly right. Exactly right, yeah. From here, it is, okay, the question is it possible, once I've changed this data context, an excellent question, once I change this data context, is it possible to refer to the data context of the parent? You can, but it takes a little more code, and it's really cryptic, and I ain't going to show it to you. It's something called relative ancestor. So if you use relative ancestor, you can go back up the context tree. So, yes, the answer is yes. The answer is yes for almost everything, just some things take a little jumping through loops to do it. Now, here's the important thing. In this other button that's down here, I am grabbing the source object off the data context, and this time I am programmatically changing it. So if I have this text box bound to name, I would expect, let's say I am going to change, what was I changing it to? I'm changing it to Miguel, right? So let's say that I change this to John. The text box is now John. Did John travel from the text box to the object? Well, let's check. Yes, it did. Now I'm going to change the object to something else, to Miguel. Is it going to travel back up to the text box? And the answer is it's not. That's what I meant by the end of the last session when I said by default, the binding is actually going to be just one way. It travels from the underlying object to all the visual controls upon first binding. Only on that first binding. Once after you're bound and rendered for the first time, any changes to the object properties do not automatically refresh the view unless you do a little more work. And that's what we're going to get into now. So now, let's write our first view model. So we have the exact same source object, the exact same model. There it is right there. I'm writing my first view model. Let's see what the view model is. The view model starts out as just a class. That's all it is. This class is going to become the binding source of my view at the top level. Anything that I want to put in that view should be driven by this view model in the form of properties, in the form of state exposure. Now, what I want is that I want this view, remember, model has item, and then item has name, right? But I changed it a little bit. I flattened out the model. I didn't want that complex model to drive my view. I wanted a simpler model. So I have this sample view model here that's got a property called name. And my model is contained inside the view model. So as you can see here, source object is injected into the constructor, and then the scope is widened so I can use it throughout the class. So now my view model wraps my model. You see that? It's the layer above the model. Now the name property just returns model.item.name and sets model.item.name. So it flattens it out a little. But it needs one additional thing. There's this interface here called iNotifyPropertyChange. And what happens is that when you, and this has been around for a long time, Windows Forms uses this and so does the web. What happens is that when a view binds to a class, that view is designed to peek into, it reflects into this class and see if this class implements iNotifyPropertyChange. iNotifyPropertyChange defines one member only, and that's an event called property changed of delegate type property change event handler. The view, when it has this model bound to its data context at anywhere in the visual tree, the view will look at that object and say, do you implement iNotifyPropertyChange? If the answer is yes, it will wire itself to this event. So now you in the view model can call this event to notify the view that a certain property has changed, and the view will automatically execute a rebind on that property. So what I did is that this property is of type property change event handler, which uses property change event args, which contains the property name, and it is a string. So I just write a couple of simple overloads. Like here's an overload, a method called onPropertyChanged, which takes the property name, and all that does is call, as a matter of fact, you know what I mean? You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to erase that, and I'm going to do this because I'm only going to use this one. There we go. There. So I just wrote a helper method to help me raise that event. So I can just call a method called onPropertyChange with the name of a property, and then I can check to see if something's wired in that event, and if it has, I'm going to raise the event, and in the event args, I'm going to send the name of the property. And once I got this helper method here, all I got to do is anywhere in the view model where I'm going to change a property value, I make a call that looks like this. Rebound, yeah, or the binding to be refreshed. It essentially gives you two-way binding. Yeah. Well, previously it was, it's not that it was one, previously it was just one way. That's correct. Now, you effectively have two-way binding here, but you can still back up into just one way with a couple of extra things that you probably don't want to do. I'll talk about that later. But, yeah, you've turned one-way binding into two-way binding is what you've done. So now if I go to my view.
Why are you using a string literal to define the property change?
Because I, okay, the question is why, and it's a good question, too. Why am I using a string literal? Because the property change event args, which is the args that I have to send through the property, just takes a string as the property name. So at the end of the day, that's what I'm going to need. Now, I know where your mind is going, and that's where mine goes as well. I have in my MVVM framework, I actually use a cool little lambda expression that I can have compile time checking. So in my framework, my code would look like this. My code would look just like this. And then I would have compile time checking. But then my onPropertyChanged helper method, the virtual method that I wrote, would grab that lambda expression and use reflection to turn it into a string. Because ultimately, it has to fire off that event, and that event wants a string, because that's what they designed it to hold. So I'd have to change it. But at least I'll get compile time checking, because, yes, if you spell like me, you'll be doing this at some point, and all hell's going to break loose.
No, you wouldn't know at all.
You wouldn't know at all. You'd have to start, you know, number one, debugging, number two, tearing your hair out. And as you can see, I've done a lot of that. Well, you're specifying .name equals value, yes, but there's no listening mechanism built in, neither in WPF, nor web forms, nor Windows. That's why this interface has been around in the system component model namespace for a long time. It's just really started to shine and show its face in WPF because people need to know more about it. Once I have that done, if I go into my view, you can see that my view looks exactly the same. The difference is that I'm not going, and I'll explain this a little later, the difference is I'm not going another level deep. The view model itself is going to become my, as a matter of fact, let me get rid of this. Let me go into the code behind and wire my view model. So the binding is going to happen to the code behind, to the view model. And the view model is just going to bind to view title. The view is going to bind to view title, and the label is going to bind to name. That's simple. It doesn't no longer need item.name. It no longer needs item in the data context of the grid. It's now a flatter model. It's essentially a different object that I'm binding to. I'm not binding to that model object anymore that's three dimensions, that's two levels deep. I'm binding to a simpler object that's one level deep and that has compensated for what it thinks is a shortcoming of the model, which is a complex object hierarchy. So here's name, and here's view title. Now notice this view title doesn't get the same stuff that name does. In fact, it only has a getter. It doesn't even have a setter. That's simply because I have my only intention with the view title property is to use it as a display only. It's never going to go into a text box, so I'm not going to waste my time with this. It's just excess code at that point. Well, the answer is the question is if you have a business object that's got three properties and it's bound to a view, if you've refreshed that entire business object from the database, do you have to call this onProperty change for each one? Well, the answer is yes and no. Normally you would, but if you really are just refreshing, hey Danny, if you really are just refreshing the entire object, you can basically refresh the entire data context. You can do this programmatically by setting data context to null and then setting it again. And that will refresh the entire thing. But this is the technique that you want to get used to anyway. And in the second half, in the after lunch session, I'm going to talk about frameworks, because a lot of frameworks or a lot of designs will want you to do this in the business layer. Because there's one thing that I haven't talked about yet is how you expose the model in your view model. And the answer is however you want. So for example, here's an example. Let me show you, first of all, let's run this application, make sure it works, okay? Make sure that everything that I've told you is not a lie. So I'm going to change this to John and say submit. And it says text box says John, right? Now I'm going to say change me, and it should be changed to Miguel, right? There we go. Now, two things that I want to point out. First of all, do you notice the little thing down here? I should have shown you that in the previous hour. This is the beauty of the binding in XAML. You can bind one thing to another. This little doohickey down here, here's a label that has content name. Here's a text box that's bound to name. Okay? I also have this label. Where is it? Oh, I also have this label that's bound to name as well. Now, somebody, who was it that was talking to me about binding two controls to the same source? That was you, right? Okay, here's what I'm talking about. I got 2 points of volatility here, because if I always need that text box and that label to be identical for whatever reason, I just bound both of them to the view model. But what if I change the name of that view model property to first name, for example? I now got to remember to change it here or change it here. But something else that I can do is the following. What's the name of the property that's bound in the text box? It's called text, right? So I can bind this to text and now say element name equals text one and make sure that I have a name here. And now I've just bound those two together. Now the effect is going to be the same. Watch this. Change me, exactly the same effect, but I have 1 point of volatility only. Another thing that I want to show you is that by default, watch this. By default, look when the binding takes place. Oh, for that, I got to change it back. Look when the underlying, unless you're doing element-to-element binding like I just did, look what happens when two things are bound to the same one, to the same underlying object. This is going to demonstrate when that underlying object gets updated. Watch this. Miguel was here. Now watch this. As soon as I tab out, then the object receives the notification that the text has changed, and it's going to receive the update in the property. That may or may not be the effect that you want. If you want an immediate effect, you have to change what's called the update source trigger right there from default, and default and lost focus are the same thing, to property changed, which is what I usually do. And if you change it to property changed, what happens is that it's almost the same thing as saying key press. So now, every time that you change this visual object, the underlying object gets changed. Okay? Now, that little value is not available in Silverlight, unfortunately. It's a WPF-only thing. Silverlight is only a loss focus update as opposed to property change. And that's going to become important when I show you commanding later.
The label
is bound to the text box, which right now it's not. Right now it's bound to the object. So then when the object gets changed is when this label is going to get changed, which means when this was its default value, notice until I tabbed out, the label didn't receive the value. But now that I made that update source trigger equals property change, which means it's instant, as soon as I change the text box letter by letter, the name property of the underlying object gets a refresh. And since this is bound to that, this gets the refresh from it automatically because this receives the refresh from what? From the onProperty changed event. Okay? You're making me walk, dude. That's all right. No, I need to walk. I can't. I need to exercise a leg if it's going to get better. The hip. All right. Now, another thing that I want to show you here before I get into commanding is techniques for exposing the model. You're going to see two schools of thought here, and both of them are right. There's no wrong here. You're going to see a model that has a business object that has five properties: first name, last name, address, city, state, and zip. Okay, six. Seven, email. Okay? Then you can expose that object in a view model. You have two choices. Either duplicate the properties, which means you have seven properties there, and each property is going to look very similar to this. It's going to return the property in the model, and it's going to set the property in the model. Or the other choice that you have is expose the model in a single property like this. What's the model type here? Source object? Source object model. And expose it in a single property. Okay? Here's the difference. First of all, if you do this, then the model object, the source object, has to have those on property changed calls in itself. And a lot of good business frameworks, anybody use CSLA, for example? Okay, a lot of good business frameworks like CSLA or like Spring or a lot of other good frameworks have this capability where all the business objects will notify property change. But if that's not the case, there's your perfect example of the view model needing to compensate where the model falls short. And you would need to duplicate the properties. And a lot of times you may be using somebody's business tier that was given to you that you don't have access to the source. So you may not be able to rely on them doing everything correctly. You have a question?
Is there any way to expose the individual properties to the model and let them without exposing the model itself by running parameterized method or something?
No, you can't do a parameter. No, because you can't bind in XAML. You can't bind to collection values. You have to bind to hard properties. No, there isn't. The question was, is there any way to just, instead of exposing the model, bind to a list of parameters or something like that? And you can't do that. The other reason for these two schools of thought on either duplicating properties in the view model as opposed to just exposing the entire model through a single property, there's a couple of other reasons. First of all, your model may be really, really elaborate. It may be pretty deep, four levels deep in child objects. It may have 100-plus properties. Maybe your view model just wants to expose 20 of them. You don't want to give the view access to the others. So you give the view the properties that you want to expose you give the view model properties that you want to expose to the view only. The other thing is late model binding, which is very, very common. You got a data form. Data form has got 7 text boxes in it, name, address, city, state, zip, and email, right? And you may want to show those properties from the model, have the ability to change them, but have the ability to cancel and only move them to the model when you hit OK, because then the model will have the capability of moving them to the database. In which case, if you're using this technique like this, as soon as you change a text box, it's going to immediately update the model, and you may not want that. So you may have a different technique for transfer to the model later when I try to do a save. You understand what I mean? So there's various reasons for that, and just get used to that. Don't get hung up on like, oh, man, I got to duplicate those properties. I mean, yes, sometimes you have to, sometimes you don't. Sometimes you have to duplicate all of them. You have to duplicate what you want to expose. You have to put the properties in there that you want to expose. If your model is too thick and you don't want to expose all of it, put the properties that you want to expose. Sometimes your view is going to be made of different sources, 5 different models, 5 different business objects, like Michelle, in which case your view model is going to expose 2 properties from this model, 2 properties from this one, and a collection from a third. And now you got a tight little view model that simply is going to be exposed to this view, and the view knows nothing else except what that view model has to show it. Make sense? All right. You're going to see these exercises of the view model stuff being repeated more and more, okay? I want to continue. We got about 20 minutes. There we go. Okay, as far as hooking up a view model, you just saw a view-first approach, okay? The view-first approach is the fact that I got my view. I have my view here, and in my view, the view comes up first, and then in the constructor of the view, I instantiate the view model. And I hook up the view model to the data context. This is called a view-first approach. And then in that view model, I somehow get the model in there. Whether I inject the model through a constructor, in this case, I have both. I have the ability to inject an existing model through a constructor, or if I do what the current view does, which is just instantiate a view model, then the default constructor just instantiates a new model. And that's just for demo purposes. How you get the two linked together is entirely up to you. Well, that's the same thing with view model hooking. The easiest way to hook in a view model is this way, to just view first and then set the data context equal to this. There's a few other techniques that you can use. One technique is, and I'll skip the slide and I'll just show you, is that I can do this, get rid of this, and now I'm going to get rid of this. That's design time hooking. And this is still view first approach, but now what I've done is I've done something good and I've done something bad. The good thing that I've done is that I have given what happens in a situation like this is that an instance of this view model class, sample view model, is going to get instantiated at design time. So right now, an instance just got instantiated for me in the designer without running the application. So number one, hope to God that you don't have anything in the view model that's going to depend on runtime dependencies that's going to cause this to blow up, because then your view here will just turn big and yellow and looks like a big ugly error screen. Okay. Number two, you cannot do this unless your view model has a default constructor. The minute your view model does not have a default constructor, this happens. The view is going to break now. See? You can only do that if your view model has a default constructor. Now, the good thing is that if your view model exposes hard-coded properties like this one, this is a view name, now right away, I'm going to get that. Watch. Let me recompile. I'm going to get that. You see, this is my view name right up here. That didn't show up before. It's a runtime value. But since the designer is instantiating my view model, it's binding it right away. Now, that may be enough design time experience for some things. It's not going to be enough design time experience for list controls. So I'm going to get into that in the next hour when I talk about design time data. But the bad part that I don't like about this is the fact that you're now coupling the view to the view model, and I don't like that idea. So I tend to stay away from this technique. But it's a quick way to do it if you want to do a no-code approach for a good demo. And a lot of people do it this way. But to me, this is you've just bound this view to this single view model. And that's not the kind of coupling that I want to see. Okay? The other techniques are just modifications of the first one. They're not rocket science. There's a code behind technique where you go in the view of origin, and there's a code behind technique where you go in the view of destination. So usually, let's say you're navigating from one view to the next. Well, your one view can instantiate the second view, instantiate its view model, hook the two up together, and then show the next view, which is what I'm doing here. In the view of origin, there's my model, there's my view model, instantiate the view, and then set the data context to the view model and show the dialogue. That's in the view of origin. Or I can modify it and say in the view of destination, where I call upon the view of destination, and it's in its constructor, I do this stuff, which is what I did in the previous code example. So it's just a combination of things, and you decide how you want to do it. There are much, much fancier ways of hooking up view models. When you start to learn how to use frameworks like Prism and Meth, who uses Meth here? Who's a Meth head? Meth? It's pretty cool, huh? Well, Meth, especially if you use Prism, Meth has the ability to do the new Meth has full-blown dependency injection. It acts as a full-blown dependency injection container, and you can use a DI container to manage all your view models, where view model hooking happens automatically just by exporting view models and importing information. So that's much more complicated, and I'm not going to get into it. But there are advanced techniques for doing this. There's also the use of a locator pattern. Some people employ locator patterns where a third-party class takes care of doing the instantiation and matching two things up, matching a view with a view model. Then there's a technique called view model first, which I'll talk about in the next thing, where you use data templates to resolve the view model. So everything is view model, view model, view model, and a list somewhere else of mappings will say, okay, when I have this view model, pop this view into place. When I have this view model, pop this view into place. And that has very specific usage scenarios. The truth is every application is probably going to use more than one scenario to do view and view model hooking, depending on how you got to that particular form. So don't try to lock your mind into, I want to do this one way, I always want to use a locator service. Every application is probably going to use two or three techniques combined. And they're not rocket science. They're just one's a modification of the previous. All right, so let's talk about commanding, because that's going to be an important thing. All right, let's jump straight to the code. Anybody got anything against that? Or are you guys like real PowerPoint junkies? No? All right, we'll go to code. One guy's saying, oh, code, code, code. All right, so what's a command? Well, everything we've talked about so far is about state driving, okay, which means your view model contains state that is going to drive your view. But the view is going to contain other things other than just visual stuff, right? It's also going to contain behavior, which means your view is going to contain some objects. And traditionally, you take a button, I mean some buttons, you take a button and you double click on it, it's got a click event. So you put some action code in the click event, and that's what's going to get executed when you click on the button. Well, I'd like for this action code to be encapsulated in my view model. Well, WPF has a technology that's not has nothing to do with MBVM, but it will when I get done with it. It's a technology called commanding, which Silverlight just got on Silverlight 4. Prior to Silverlight 4, commanding is not around for Silverlight, which means if you're a Windows Phone 7 developer, you don't have commanding yet because Windows Phone 7 uses Silverlight 3. Danny, is there any indication at all as to when they're going to increase the Silverlight rev for Phone 7 development? Okay. So, yeah, I kind of figured that when we start to see Silverlight 5 on the desktop, then we'll see Silverlight 4 on the phone. So it's going to be one revision behind. Oh, okay. Well, commanding is a big thing, and you'll see why it's a big thing when I show it to you. So I'm sure a lot of phone developers are waiting anxiously for commanding to make it into the game. So let's talk about what a command is. A command is a class that can execute some behavior. So in a way, that sounds, you know, pretty trivial, right? Well, we can do that in a click event. No big deal. Well, here's an example of a command. A command is a class that implements the iCommand interface. That iCommand interface gives you three members to implement. The first one is an execute. I'll talk about the parameter in a few minutes. The first one's an execute method. The execute method is what the action of that command is going to be. So in this case, I am checking this parameter that came in, and then I'm just showing it in a message box, okay? Now, the cool thing about a command is that a command could also have some intelligence to tell whoever is using it, should I be able to execute this command, yes or no? And that's where this can execute comes in. So you can write some funky logic code in there to return a true or false to determine whether this command can be executed or not. And then the third one is this event. And this event is called can execute changed. And whoever fires off this event is basically telling whatever is listening for these commands to re-query this here. Because whatever status helps in determining whether this command can execute or not has now changed. So we should check for this again. Okay? So it starts to sound like a pretty complex thing. Well, the good thing about commands is that once we write a command like this one just shows a message box, and then this one basically will return a true unless the value of this parameter that comes in is the word false. If that word happens to be false, then this is going to return a false. I know it sounds stupid, but I needed something to determine whether it's going to return true or false. Okay? So it's really just a very elementary command. But let's see how it actually works. Because now I got a view here, and this view has this button called simple command. And this button, notice this button does not have a click event. Instead, this button is bound with something called a command property. So a lot of XAML controls implement an interface called iCommandSource. And if they implement the interface iCommandSource, they are command-compatible controls. And the buttons and the links are command-compatible controls. So every command-compatible control, like the button, it's the only one we're going to stick with for now, the button, gives you this command property. It also gives you a command parameter property. And that command parameter property is what's going to be shoved into that parameter that you saw as an object. Now, this can be set to any kind of binding. Now, this teaches you something brand new here. There's two types of bindings. You've learned one of them. You've learned the squiggly marks binding. And when you say binding something, whatever the path is on that binding, whatever the next word is, that has to be a property of whatever the underlying data context is, right? We've already seen that. But a binding could also be a static resource. A static resource is an object that gets defined as a resource, either here or somebody asked me earlier about the app.xaml. Who was that? Or at the beginning. Okay, you can define a whole list of resources in the app.xaml and access them. What I've done here is narrow the scope of a resource so that only this window has access to it, so I put it in the resources section of this window. And what I've done is that I've just defined an instance of that simple command. So when this renders, when this XAML renders, when it gets to this point here, it's actually going to instantiate that simple command class, and it's going to hang on to an instance of it, and it's going to call it CMD simple. Because then elsewhere on my XAML, I can refer to CMD simple as a static resource. Okay? Now, I promise you that I'd show you about namespaces because we didn't do them in the last one. Well, the simple command comes from a namespace called MVVM demo. So in order to access it from my XAML, I have to tell my XAML where that namespace is. So I have defined an XML namespace called local, which is a CLR namespace MVVM demo. And if this was in a different assembly, then I would have to say semicolon assembly equals and then the name of the assembly. That's all. And once that namespace prefix has been defined, I can then access anything in that namespace like this, local colon. Huh? Of course. If it's in a different assembly, it has to be referenced. Absolutely. VM. Yeah. I had a VM namespace in the first example. You're absolutely right. Nobody called me on that. Nobody called me on that. Why do I have a VM namespace? Because the sample view model was in mvvmdemo.viewmodel namespace. So I defined it up here, and now I can use VM colon. That VM, what's your name?
Avi.
Avi? Okay, that VM could be Avi. As long as if I define it as Avi, then I got to say Avi sample view model. Okay? All right, so let's take a look. Let's see if this command works, okay? And let's just to jump the gun a little bit, because commands is all I'm going to have time for here. Peter, is the stuff here yet? Okay, then I'm going to continue until the pizza gets here. Is that all right? Okay, so look at the second button. The second button is using that same command, but now the command parameter is receiving something. In the first one, there's no command parameter. So this value here will always be null. But the second one is executing that same command, but the command parameter is binding to the text property of text box one element. And it's sending that value in. So whatever the value of this text box is right down here is what this command is going to receive in the parameter in both situations. You understand? And one other thing, because I'm hooking up this command totally manually and I'm not depending on any kind of view model binding, what happens is that this can execute will get checked once and once only upon the first binding. I have to then tell it manually when the heck should I check for this can execute again. And since I'm depending on the value of this parameter coming in, I want to refresh this can execute change every time that I type something in the text box, right? So I did a lot of manual work here, which really sucks. I mean, look at the code behind of this form. I tapped into the text changed event of the text box, grabbed the resource, the command, it's in my resources, right? I defined it in my resources, so I have to grab it in the resources collection, cast it to a simple command, and then if I found it, I'm going to do command.refresh. And command.refresh is a helper method that I put in here myself so I can raise that event. That's something that I did manually. So I had to do a lot of work in order to accomplish this effect right here. Simple command, there's no parameter. However, the message box showed, so we know that the action worked. What about this one? I'm going to type Miguel, simple command 2. There we go. Now, how do I know that that can execute is working? Because if I type the word false, it refreshes and it queries it. So I get this enable-disable built in. This is the beautiful feature of commanding is that what that can execute does is that it's bound directly to the enabling of whatever button you're binding to the command, which is really cool. Yeah?
Can we hook up this event handler to command?
Say again?
Can we hook up this event handler for text box to some command?
The event handler of the text box.
Right? Like right now you have code behind for text change.
Yep.
Can we just put some command like...
There is no command property in the text box. No, no. What you got to do is the next thing that I'm going to show you, and that's going to be the last thing. Even if the pizza gets here, I got to show you this anyway. Pizza's not here anyway. That's a bunch of Microsoft people. Okay, so here's where the problem is. Let's say, for example, let's take this real world. We got a view model that shows some information. It has some properties, and those properties are reflected on the screen in some text boxes. Then that view, where those properties are from the view model, where those text boxes are, has a button, and the button is called submit or save, right? Which means that the command behind the button, because I want to use commanding here, so I got to write a command that is going to execute something. And what do I want this button to do? I want it to take the information from the screen and save it to the database. Now, if I have this information down in my view model, obviously I don't want to use the code behind. I want to take advantage of the fact that I already have a class that contains all the updated properties, so let me figure out a way to save that. Can we agree on that? So now I wrote a command called simple command in my first example, which is a separate class, where I have this execute button, this execute action. So it'd be great if I can tell that execute to grab those properties and save them to the database. With me so far? But I got a view model class and I got a separate command class. How the hell are those two going to see each other? You understand the dilemma here? A little bit of, we need to do some fancy hooking here. But it doesn't have to get that fancy. The solution is actually pretty simple, and the solution has become an industry accepted pattern called either delegate command or relay command. Has anybody heard these terms out surfing the web? Delegate command or relay command? What a delegate command is, I like to use the term delegate command. What a delegate command is a single class whose T defines the type of parameter, if you're going to use one, which I'm not going to for now, and that class is the implementer of the I command. So in this case, we're not writing a bunch of different command classes. We're not going to write a save command class that implements I command. We're going to use this beautiful delegate command, because what happens is that this I command is going to force us to implement the execute and the can execute, right? So what is execute and can execute going to do this time? Well, all it's going to do is that it's going to fire off these delegate types that come in through the constructor of delegate command. So basically, I'm going to use this delegate command to be able to house the actual implementation of execute and can execute in my view model. Let me show you what the view model looks like, and this will make more sense to you. Now I got the sample view model, and the sample view model's got a property now. It's a public property, which means it's going to be exposed in the view model as a property. And this property is called simple command. Okay? So the property is called simple command. And you know what? We'll leave it a simple command. But look at the type now. The type is delegate command of object. It's got to be something, so we'll just leave it as object. So the type is delegate command, and it's just a getter and a setter. I want to expose it publicly, but I don't want to change it publicly, which is why I limited the scope on the setter. Then, in the constructor of my view model, I'm going to instantiate simple command. And look how I'm instantiating it. I'm instantiating it and sending to those two delegate arguments two methods that are within my view model itself. Right there. So now this command, when this command's execute fires, it's going to fire off whatever method came into that delegate argument, which is going to be a method inside my view model. And that's how I'm able to put a command in my view model and hook these two things together. Because now this here is going to have full access to every property that's defined in my view model. And that's how we do commanding mixed in with MVVM. Is that unclear to anybody? Because this is an important pattern. Does anybody need me to explain that in any other way? Okay. No? Okay. Once again, we got this delegate command. Delegate command is the implementation of I command, which means it has the can execute and the execute. But the code that we're putting in there is simply going to fire off a delegate. See that argument right there? That variable underscore execute? See how it's defined as an action of T? And it comes into the constructor. When I instantiate delegate command, I send an argument into the constructor, and this is just chaining the constructor, so you can see a this at the end of it, and it's just going to widen the scope of it. So then in my view model, when I instantiate that, I'm instantiating simple command as new delegate command, and in the constructor, I'm sending to it the name of the method inside this view model that I actually want to execute. Because now the button, watch what happens. Remember, our view is going to be bound to sample view model. But now simple command is just a property of sample view model. So now my view is actually going to be simpler because the view doesn't need a static resource anymore. Notice the static resource is gone. There's the view model, and that's it. But look what the button, look how the button is bound now. Binding simple command. That's it. Say again?
Now you have view model.
Oh, that's a much more advanced thing. That's where events come into play. Yeah, that's a great question. Why? How would I move the message box? I definitely don't want the message box in my view model. This here, you don't ever want to do this. This is just for my demo, just so you can see something happen. In reality, what I would do is that I would have to create an event in the view model, and then here I would raise that event. And the view, since the view has a reference to the view model, the view would wire itself to that event, and then in the code for the event would raise the message box. Understand?
Yes.
So now the execute, does this make more sense? So now there's my execute, and here's my can execute. My can execute is real simple, because look at the view. The view's got the text box, which is bound to the name. So because the text box is bound to the name, there's the name property. Every time the text box changes, it's going to always update that name, right? That's its underlying data context. So look what the can execute does. It just returns a true or false based on name being empty. And the automatic beauty of this is that automatically, when anything in your view model calls on property change, whenever the view receives an on-property change notification, automatically it signals the command manager to re-query all of the commands on the view for a can execute check. But that happens all automatically. Yeah.
Is the main purpose of the whole command class construct just for kind of use validation? Is there anything that it gives you specifically that you put into a regular kind of?
Yep, I'm going to show you. I'm going to show you. That's the last thing I'm going to show you before I let you go for a peek. Huh? The question is there anything that this commanding model gives you that just tapping into the click event does not? And that's what I'm about to show you. So indulge me for 1 minute so I can show you how this works. Watch this. View model commanding. Now watch this. As soon as I type something, I get the button. As soon as it's empty, the button goes away. You can, but you're writing more code. Well, here's the important answer to your question. I can write a view model test now, a unit test, that actually tests that sample view model and tests that command, and I couldn't do that if it was in the code behind. So that's a big key difference to this, and that's why that's an important question, okay? And the other thing is that it's a real nice encapsulation. I now have a binding source for that view that not only includes state, but it now includes behavior as well. So I don't have that scattered in two different places, state in one place and behavior in the other. I have that encapsulated in one, and once again, that makes it easier to test those things together. And the fact that they can't execute, you get that out of the box. I mean, you got, when I do my MBVM thinking thing at the beginning of the next session, it's going to become totally crystal clear to you because I'm going to show you one problem solved two ways, complete code behind approach and no code behind complete view model approach using commanding. And you're going to see how cleaner the view model approach is. It's going to make a lot more sense to you. Definitely the way I showed it in the view model. What is the question is, what is the best practice for using commanding? Having your commands be separate classes? You can use that what button? A print button. Right, I understand that. And I agree with you. Okay, so the gentleman's question is, what if I have a print button and the print functionality is pretty either the same or similar for many, many views? What if I were to write that print button, as that print command behind that button as a separate class, I should be able to reuse it. And you can do that, but there's a better approach to that. And I'm going to talk about that in the next session when I talk about view model inheritance. Because your view model can be comprised of chains of view models, of an inheritance chain, to solve that very problem, and I'm going to demonstrate that. I'll take one more question, and then we got to go. Yes, sir. Okay, great question. What if your control does not have command enabling capability, like the list box, for example? Wouldn't it be great to, instead of selected index changed event, to be able to tie a command into the list box? Well, without any additional help, you can't do it. You would have to have that code in your code behind. However, there is a light at the end of the rainbow, and I'm not prepared to demo it here, but the answer is behaviors. You can write custom behaviors. Anything that you think you can't do in WPF, You actually can if you're willing to write a custom behavior. And there's a lot of behaviors that are that are so common that they're built in. And Blend, the Blend SDK, if you install the Blend SDK, which is a single DLL on your system, has something called an activity behavior where you can tie any event from any control to fire off a command. And using that behavior, you can tie the selected index changed event from, let's say, a tree or a list to fire off a command. So that makes up for the shortcoming of some controls not having command-enabled capability. Answer your question? Let's go have lunch, and we'll continue when we come back.